All right, good morning. Welcome to the 2016 Sunstone Symposium. We're short one person, but we're going to get started, and hopefully he gets here and can hop in. So this is the session titled Black and White, The Challenges of Colonialism in Mormon Art and Scholarship. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It's the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of the session following the remarks of the presenters. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. The session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our Sunstone special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skullcandy official headphones, customized just for Sunstone. That's kind of cool. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books, and consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholarship. This session is not quite 60 minutes now. We ask that both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so that we can allow the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after the session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation. So to this session, depicting ethnic diversity within Mormon art and scholarship often magnifies the religion's white dominant membership. For example, J. Kirk Richards' Eve and the Fruit of the Tree of Knowledge, which depicts a nude black Eve, drew criticism for presenting an exoticized black woman naked and up for auction. Since depictions of black Mormons in history, sociology, and art are mostly produced by whites, this panel asks the question, to what extent is the black image in Mormonism affected by a white filter? Presenters will speak in the following order. They'll give a few remarks, and then we've decided to turn this into a roundtable discussion, and then open it up for questions. So first we'll hear Misha McGriggs, a PhD candidate in counseling psychology at Brigham Young University. Her academic research focuses primarily on multicultural competence in psychology. She contributes to several blogs, including the Huffington Post, and she's headed to Seattle on Monday, leaving us. Russell Stevenson is an author and historian of race, religion, gender, and the Mormon tradition. His book, For the Cause of Righteousness, A Global History of Blacks and Mormonism, 1830 to 2013, won the 2015 Best Book Award from the Mormon History Association. And Nancy Ross is an assistant professor of art history at Dixie State University and has a PhD in the same field from the University of Cambridge. She is the contributing editor for medieval art at Mart History, a subsidiary of Khan Academy, and a member of the Art History Pedagogy, is that right? And practice Board. And then finally, if Brad Kramer is here, he'll jump in. Brad has a PhD in anthropology from the University of Michigan. He is an instructor at Utah Valley University, where he is currently teaching a section on the cultural anthropology of Mormonism. He's the owner of the Written Vision Gallery and Bookstore in Provo. So we'll open it up to our presenters.
Hello. Are we? No?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes? Okay. Sorry, we're going to go slightly out of order from what was in the program. So I'm Nancy Ross, and I'm going to be starting our discussion for today. And I apologize that we were not quite able to get our slides up and running. So we're going to have a panel on art, and you're just going to have to imagine everything that we're saying, pretty much. So, which is a little unusual when we're discussing art. But so you're just going to have to go with the flow here. You may or may not be aware of the circumstances that led to the creation of this particular panel. A number of months ago, J. Kirk Richards produced a painting of Black Eve. And the Black Eve is nude from the waist up, and she is presented with her body facing the viewer, and her head is turned to the side, and it's typical of J. Kirk Richards' work, it's in a fairly, as an art historian, I would say loose style. It's maybe more impressionistic than overly realistic or hyper-realistic. And this particular painting was very well received by the progressive Mormon community. And a few months after that, in a Facebook group, it it kind of came up that Black women were not happy with this image and found that it was very problematic. And in listening to these comments from Black women in, I believe it was the Feminist Mormon Housewives Facebook group, I became interested in trying to kind of deconstruct the image to try to figure out where they were coming from while also being aware of where Kirk was coming from. So in a larger sense, so I'm an art historian, and I would say that of all the disciplines I have ever encountered, art is about the worst with regard to race and to acknowledging and accepting the role of different identities with regard to both the subject matter and the people being represented. And I'm just going to talk you through an example of when I first properly encountered this was in a class in a few years ago. Where I was teaching 20th century art history, and we looked at the different ways in which heterosexual male artists represented nude women, heterosexual women artists represented nude women, and lesbian women artists represented nude women. And there were very distinctive differences, and each of those groups treated the nude female body in a very different way. And even though that wasn't with regard to race specifically, we were able to see as a class how identity played such a strong role in our perception of the subject matter and why that was really an essential component of understanding art. Picasso and others of his time really felt that their artistic creativity came from their male sexual energy, and they were very clear about speaking about that often. You know, you have to have a penis, preferably a white penis, to kind of make art work well, or to create art that was going to be well received by a contemporary 20th century audience. And of course, that's hugely, hugely problematic. When I was thinking about what I want to talk about for our presentation today, I'm a medieval art historian, and so I'm very familiar with art from about 500 to about 1500, even though I teach a lot of different things. And I think that often we're not aware of the history of Christian art, and that many artists today, religious artists today, aren't necessarily creating an art that is aware of the tradition of Christian art, because the tradition of Christian art isn't just the tradition of white Jesus. And I was really thinking about white Jesus and representations of Jesus and thinking about our conversation today. So there is a tradition within Christianity that emerged from like the 13th century Byzantine Empire that St. Luke, the evangelist who authored the gospel, painted the first image of Mary and Jesus, the virgin and child. And so that would make Luke the first Christian artist, and many works of art reflect this idea. But when we look back at the earliest images of Christian art, we see that Christ is the Good Shepherd, or in many other guises, that Christ is reflective of the people who made him. And so if we often talk about the problem of making God in our own image, that is what Christian artists have always done. And even though that phrase has a very negative connotation, it's actually very important. It's very important that we make God in our own image when we are reflective of that, and to realize that different groups of people need to make God in their own image, and that when we over-identify God with a particular identity, that creates a lot of problems. And so if you can imagine a flurry of slides that where we see Jesus of many different colors in many different places. And so what we would see is that in Ireland in about the year 800, Jesus has red hair, because that makes sense for Ireland. And we would also note that in Persia in the 11th century, Jesus and Mary look like Persian kings and queens and their children, and that makes sense for their people. And that when people from the Mediterranean region are painting Jesus, Jesus is a variety of shades of brown, because that is appropriate to the Mediterranean region. And that black Jesus was actually quite popular in medieval France. Okay, and so Jesus appears in all of in many different ways, including Chinese Jesus in the 19th century. And so throughout Christian history, Christians have always felt that flexibility and embraced that flexibility to represent God in their own image. One thing that we have is that Mormon art is very tied to the Western tradition, the Western artistic tradition, and really to classicism and to the Renaissance, which revived classicism, where Jesus needs to be white and often blonde and often strong, because his spiritual power is often associated with his physical power, and that's where we get wild Freiburg, you know, Nephis, who are like more buff than Hercules. And so, but it's not as though, and we might think to ourselves with a limited knowledge of religious art, that Christian art must be tied to white Jesus. But really, the tradition of Christian art before the Renaissance tells us that Christian art was never tied to white Jesus, and that we can, and if we need to find excuses to move away from white Jesus, like that's not a difficult thing, because we have so many examples of Jesus being represented as a variety of different colors and ethnicities, and that's what the history of Christian art tells us. Sorry, that's kind of a long rambly rant thing, but I'm going to move this, grab this, and probably pull it out, and then give this to Russell.
All right. Thanks so much for your comments, and let me just add that thanks, or should I say no thanks, to Arnold Freiburg, generations of Mormon men feel incredibly insecure about their bodies, all right? So, thanks, Freiburg. So, a little bit of background. Over the course of the past 24 hours, I have been in the air for about 24 hours, give or take. I spent the past month or so in Nigeria doing oral history research on the history of Mormonism there, you know, and how it developed indigenously and independently of the official American ecclesiastical structure. And in the first few days that I was there, I was staying at one of the better hotels in the area, and they were having a Miss Beautiful Nigeria pageant. I kind of stumbled across this. I said, okay, I'm bored. This looks fun. And within about 5 minutes of my sitting down in the room, this official from the organization, he approaches me and said, hey, we would like for you to come out and do a red carpet interview. I said, I'm a nobody. What possibly could I have to offer to this? He said, no, that's fine. He comes out here. He interviews me on the red carpet with all of the, you know, the A-list celebrities who are appearing at this. And it was definitely the worst red carpet interview in the history of red carpet interviews.
The worst one you've ever done?
Worst one I've ever done. Hands down. You feel the struggle. So I'm sitting at the VIP table. Again, I've done absolutely nothing for any of this. And then the same gentleman says, hey, we would like you to help pass out some awards. For what? You know, community leadership, service. I said, okay. I go up there on the stand, and before I know it, I'm handing a major award to the chief security officer of Abia State. He's head of all the police forces, head of all kinds of things. I mean, it was one of those things where it's like, I don't know if I want to know what you're doing, but apparently you're legitimate. So I stand up there handing out these awards to these community leaders. And again, they didn't know anything about me. I brought no apparent contribution to the room, except in their eyes, one thing. I was the only white person in the room. And it became clear that in their eyes, having an American associated with the organization and with the presentation of awards, gave it a certain amount of legitimacy, especially for photo ops. There was, in their eyes, there was a visual credibility for having white people in their photos. And I use that from that now as a story for, you know, sometimes white folks say, you know, they go to other countries and they say, oh yeah, I totally know what it's like to be a minority. I get it. And okay, I was definitely a minority there, but it was not the same kind of experience as one would be having ethnic minority status here in the United States. And to a real extent, this gives us a sense for what whiteness means, even within the Mormon tradition. Now, one word that was often hurled at me as I was walking the streets of, you know, Aba or Enugu in Nigeria, it was in Igbo, it's Onyocha, right? And that it means, translates fairly simply as white person, right? But
rarely, even amongst people that I knew, even amongst people whose names I knew, that was the word that was used to describe me, kind of tossed aside in passing. And we see within the Mormon tradition that we have done an epically bad job of portraying the minority experience, visually and otherwise. You know, let's just take, for example, the depiction of Jane Manning James in the Joseph Smith film of recent production. Now, this certainly represented a step forward. Absolutely, right? At the very least, there is some kind of representation. But even then, the story that is told, it's framed in such a way that you end up seeing Jane Manning James being depicted not as the woman who is pushing for her temple endowment. You're seeing the woman who is the faithful servant, who is willing to suffer for the cause of the kingdom, who's willing to walk halfway across the country in order to join the church. All these things are correct, but the part of the story that's told is revealing. It's the story that historically we have felt very uncomfortable with. Even when I've heard it presented in BYU settings, a question always comes up afterwards. You know, the story of Jane Manning James, she pushes for endowment and ultimately is denied her. And I've heard people raise their hand and say, okay, well, was she okay with what priesthood leaders told her? Surely she was okay. Surely she just accepted this without any more questioning, and that isn't true. She continued to push over the course of the entirety of her life. But that's not a story that we're comfortable with. Similarly, with Elijah Abels, up until within the past 2 months, he has been visually absent from our record. For the very first time now, you can actually go to the Church History Museum, and there is an excellent exhibit that is devoted to his missionary work. You know, there on that nice illuminated missionary wall where you see all the different missions that were happening in the 1830s and 1840s. And it tells some pretty compelling stories about his missionary efforts and addresses racism, addresses other things. But this is in summer of 2016. That's how long it's taken us for us to visually acknowledge his existence and visually acknowledge, you know, his story. And I believe that we've suffered because of that. Now, just to close off with my remarks, sometimes I'm tempted to say, okay, well, you know, as a white person, you know, positionality matters, my relationship to the subject material matters, and, you know, that's all well and good. And sometimes I feel even tempted to say, all right, here are the rules for white people engaging in racial discourse. But really, the only rule is white people don't get to set the rules. So with that, I pass the mic to Brad. Or you have one.
Okay. I have one.
Yeah. I assume this one works?
Yes.
Okay, first of all, I want to profusely and embarrassedly apologize for coming in late, especially to my co-panelists. It's inexcusable. I have a few comments. First of all, just by way of giving, you know, an introduction that is relevant to the topic. Among other things, earlier this year, I curated an art show at a gallery in Provo that was dedicated to, sort of loosely dedicated to depictions of the temple, in which a particularly controversial work of art emerged, and it was a depiction of Eve. So you guys are aware of the Eve painting, and among other things, I think it's obviously a case study in how fraught and freighted even efforts to represent sort of racial or ethnic diversity in depictions of iconic religious imagery can still be. I'll come back to Eve and sort of my own experience and what ended up really surprising me about the conversation that ensued around that painting in a few minutes. But there are a couple of broader points that I want to make that I think are really relevant to this question about how these these tensions, these colonial, these racist, these white supremacist tensions kind of work themselves out, particularly in the art world. If nothing else, just as a way of kind of framing the conversation. And there are a couple of points that I want to make that I think are particularly relevant in this discussion. The first one is that I've become increasingly aware, just in with the work that I do in the last couple of years, of the fact that art can be a particularly effective and potent site for activism. And this is particularly the case, it's particularly true in forms of activism that are targeting cultural change, right? Not necessarily formal institutional reform or something like that, but sort of shifts in attitudes, shifts in general perception. Art can be incredibly potent. There are a couple of reasons for this. One is that the art world tends to cruise a little bit more under the radar than other sort of intellectual circles, to produce a kind of paradigm-challenging work of art or convention-challenging work of art is less overtly a provocation than writing a paradigm-challenging book or article or something like that. It's also the case because art can be much more sort of subtle. You're not laying out explicitly what it is that you're doing or what it is that you're trying to do. There's all these sort of possibilities for multiplicity of interpretation. It's also the case, and this is maybe seems a little counterintuitive or ironic, that part of the reason why art is an effective space for this kind of for these kind of shifts to occur is that that's not ever really primarily what it's about. Right? Artists who very self-consciously try to engage in activism with their work are pretty rare. It's not uncommon for an artist to understand that there are these sort of possible implications. But artists who produce sort of art for its own sake and who are, if nothing else, very self-conscious of the fact that once they produce, that the art that they produce isn't self-interpreting, that they're not going to assign a formal interpretation to it that's going to be widely interpreted, and that they can't control that interpretation, that tends to be much more the norm than artists who are producing art who want it to have sort of a narrow range of possible interpretation and want it to have a very activist purpose. And ironically, that actually kind of frees things up. One way of just imagining this is to think about, you know, for all of the conversations, for all of what's being written and discussed right now about the problem of racism in Mormonism, the problem of white centrism or white supremacism, white supremacy in Mormonism. Just imagine the impact that it would have if the temple video were racially diverse, like thoroughly racially diverse, right? That's the kind of thing that would not get formally commented on, or you wouldn't see you wouldn't see a lot of scholarship about what was happening. It would just, but the impact that it could have could be potentially enormous. So art is a place where a kind of unusually effective, if subtle, activism and sort of cultural shifts in attitudes, shifts in perceptions, is very, very possible. Having said that, in the wider fine art world, and in particular in the Mormon fine art world, is just dominated by white people. And that leads to the other point that I want to bring into the discussion, which is the problem that white activists, that white progressives, that white reformers generally, and in particular in Mormonism, have with race and race-related issues. I think that we have an impulse to appropriate progressive racial narratives. We like talking about 1978 as and sort of weaponizing it in the pressing it into the service of our own agendas, right? Saying, well, we can have the change we want to have because look how we already changed race. Look how we already had this great progressive change on race. it's a problem generally with sort of, again, with white progressivism, white activism, is that, if conservative racism is about learning to get over, like learning to live with having to treat minorities as human beings, progressive racism is about learning to recognize that the voices and perspectives of minorities matter more than yours, and that they actually have more credibility than you do, and they deserve to have their voices foregrounded more than you do. As smart and special as you are, as much as you get it or whatever, even if all those things are true, they still deserve to have more credibility. And it's hard, to sort of, like, you want to, you feel like you get it, you feel like you're trying, you feel like, you want the same things that they want, and so why should your voice not matter as much as anybody else's? So given how fraught the question of race is in the progressive community in the church, given how largely owing to its almost hegemonic whiteness, given how white, predominantly white, the fine art community is in Mormonism, and given the unusual potency that art has to affect kind of activist change or progressive change, this is just, I'm not going to pretend that I know how to resolve these tensions, or I just think that we have to have the conversation in sort of full awareness of how these tensions work. When Kirk brought the painting of Eve, I was really blown away by it visually, aesthetically, in terms of content, in terms of its ability to like shift conversations. And there's this representation of the mother of all living who is, and she's represented as black, as African, and I could see sort of all of the positive of it. And I was just, and it's a stunning piece of art. And initially that's the way that people around me were reacting to it. And then black voices started emerging that didn't see it as a sort of unified positive, as an unalloyed good. Among the other criticisms, I remember hearing more than one voice say something to the effect of you as a progressive white person are reacting differently to the nudity in this painting than you would be if it was a white woman. And like, I couldn't deny that. I couldn't deny that that was true, but that was something that I needed to have pointed out to me. That wasn't a conclusion I was going to arrive at on my own because of my own blind spots. So I think that whatever's going to happen in terms of how these tensions shift, what it is that has to happen in order for us to do better, the first thing that has to happen is that we have to get over this idea that our voices matter equally or matter most in the conversation, and we just have to listen.
So unlike Russell, who gets to walk into a room in Nigeria and be treated as an authority, I walk into a room and filled with white people, and I have to tell you exactly why I'm qualified to qualified to be here, right? Probably not qualified to be here, but I'm going to try to sell you something so you think that I am qualified. Because I had to do that as a black woman. My PhD is, I'm finishing up my PhD at BYU. It's in psychology, counseling psychology, and I study multicultural competence. And on the side, I kind of moonlight, I think as a lot of Mormons do, as like a Mormon historian. Let's take on history projects and see what we can do. And so that's kind of rolled into the podcast Color of Heaven. And I also do a blogging on issues of intersectionality. And I am one of the voices who kind of said, whoop, pump the brakes on this art, this Eve, because Eve reimagined. How can Eve be reimagined when she was already imagined, right? How can she be reimagined when she was already imagined? As in, Eve, mother of the earth, the first black person, or the first person on the earth was from Africa. So Eve was black, thank you. So to me, right, this idea of reimagining and recreating, putting people saying, like, let's do a new something new. Black Eve, Black Jesus, right? Like, again, we know in our history, in art history, that people have always depicted themselves in deity. And that's a really important thing, is that we can imagine ourselves as made in the image of God. And so if I am made in the image of God, God must be a black woman. God has to be a black woman if I was created in the image of God, just like God is also a white man. So in response a little bit to what Brad was saying just about like activism, I don't know what's happening, and I'm not an expert in European art and the purpose and the function. That's what Nancy does more, obviously. She's an expert in that. But I can tell you that black art has been alive for the consumption and enjoyment and activism of black people in this country forever. Jazz music, right? Why is jazz music so criticized? It's because you feel the music, and the music makes a statement. It doesn't have to be written out. You just play, right? So jazz music gets a lot of criticism. Langston Hughes, right, has been using his poetry as a form of activism. From the beginning, tap, dance, right? Everything that black people create for other black people, and I would say that is also true in other communities of color in America, we create things that are for us. Just because white people aren't listening or aren't going and seeing those things doesn't mean it doesn't exist and doesn't mean that it has to be reimagined. It's already there. And so the question becomes, how do I... If it becomes an important thing for white scholars and artists, right, to create a more representative mainstream audience, right, if that is an important thing, then the question becomes not how do I do this, how do I reimagine, how do I represent, but how do I use my platform to raise the voices that are already there? How do I go out? How do I mentor a young black artist, a young Latinx artist, right? How do I mentor them so that they can come and bring what they're already doing into the mainstream so that we can be blessed by it as well? Melissa Harris Perry says there's three, in her book, Sister Citizen, says there's three types of black women in America. The mammy, the Jezebel, and the angry black woman, right? We know those three women. We have given Academy Awards to only those three women. That's it. Who seemed precious? Who won the, right? Precious, okay? Who got the Academy Award? Not Precious. Mm-mm. It was Monique who got the Academy Award for being angry black woman, the abusive one, the drug one, the one who gives her daughter up in prostitution, right? Who has seen Monster Ball with Halle Berry? Mm. Doesn't she fit one of those roles? Academy Award, right? Who has seen 12 Years a Slave? Who is put up on the stage and wins the award? Right? It's the people who fall into these three categories. These are the people this is the money that we spend to see the depiction, these reduced depictions of black women.
White men have been making money off of black female bodies since the first slave ships landed in West Africa. Okay? And they continue to make money off of our bodies. And when Mormons start to make money off of our bodies, I have to say no. I've been saying no to the mainstream people, but I can't control them. But I can say no when my home, when my family does it. When my family makes money, white men make money, right? Off of the buying and the trading of my body, of my naked body. That's when I have to say no. Because in Mormonism, there's two types of black women, right? There's the faithful Jane Manning James, the faithful to the end, right? Jane Manning James, right? Who's a beautiful person with a beautiful, beautiful story. That's also complex and human, right? And complicated, because that's all of our history. She is one person, okay? You can be Jane. You get to be Jane, or you don't exist. That's the two spaces we have for women of color in the church. There's no room. We don't have room for Jezebels in the church, right? That's not a thing. But we do have, we have room for you to be faithful, or you don't exist. And so to me, again, the question is, yes, do I want to see myself in Mormon depictions of art? Yes. But the truth is that we've always been a part of the story. You don't have to reimagine the story and put people of color in the story. We've always been there. And the truth of the matter is that some of us were free in there, and some of us were slaves in there. Utah was a slave territory. Green Flake was a slave. Okay? You could pay the prophet in tithing your slave. That's the truth of the matter. So we don't have to reimagine anything. We just have to tell the truth. And so I am not anti white people telling black experiences if we cannot go to any crevices, right, and find other voices that can do it and promote those voices. I'm not anti it. But tell the truth. We have to tell the truth. We don't have to reimagine anything because the story's already there. And it makes us uncomfortable, but that's okay. Because when you're uncomfortable, some of you are feeling uncomfortable right now, now you have an idea of how I feel almost 24 hours a day, uncomfortable. Because I walk in white spaces, I go to a white church, I go to a white campus, I'm in academia, which is white, right? I live in Utah County. White. Right? We don't have to reimagine anything. We just have to tell the truth.
Thank you. And one thing I want to, if you can even follow that, I don't think that's even like a thing. But going back to this idea, you know, we have this idea of whiteness as divine. And if we think about Joseph Smith's first vision, which whether we take that as a literal thing that happened, it's a tremendously important story for Mormonism. And white Jesus and white Heavenly Father appeared to Joseph, and those are important elements of the story. Why do we have to take Joseph's vision of God the Father and Jesus as universal? You know, if Heavenly Father and Jesus had appeared to Misha, maybe they just would have appeared differently. And I think that that our stories, our Mormon stories, have been told through these white Mormon American voices almost exclusively, and that we have to make God in our own image. I say that as a white woman, and I don't actually make art. So, but the sense of, like, we all need to do that. Pew says that in America, you know, 15% of our Mormon population are people of color, but we don't see that reflected in our art. We don't see those many experiences and that diversity of experience reflected. That's all I'm going to say.
But. Yeah, thanks, Misha. That was fantastic. And I mean, the reality is, so while I was in Nigeria, I was watching CNN a lot because, frankly, I didn't understand a lot of. I don't understand Yoruba or Hausa, and they don't have a lot of TV shows in Igbo. So, I was watching CNN, and one of their key, like the taglines, was "Go there." All right, so we go there, right? We enter those spaces. And what that always meant in their visual depictions was
white men, white women, all conventionally attractive, as it were, going to areas with people of color, talking to them, taking their stories, bringing them back for American consumption. And thus we can watch these stories and we can feel ourselves to be enlightened, right? Too often that's what it ends up becoming about for white Latter-day Saint progressives, right?
White people love The Wire.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Because we can watch it and say, oh, yeah, we get urban America, right? Now we get the developing world. Now we can go to our friends at the coffee shops and go on and on about, you know, power plus prejudice equals racism. Look at how enlightened I am, right? So there's more than one way of exploiting the black and the narratives of people of color, right? It's not just about making money. It's also about building up our own intellectual and emotional and spiritual credibility, right? Right now we can walk into any room and say, see, not only am I white, do I get access to money, power, privilege, I'm also forward thinking, right? Right? I get them. Exactly. So that's all I gotta say on that. Brad?
Okay. Yeah. I just want to say something in response to one of Misha's points. I just sort of had this thing go off in my head. You were talking about, like, you were sort of pushing back against the idea of it being a reimagination of Eve, right? And I thought, well, what it really is it's not a reimagining of Eve, it's a reimagining of white Eve. It's a putting of a black body, it's an enfleshing of white Eve in a black body in a way that seems novel and sort of interesting, but I don't know, it just, I think that this is exactly why we need to be better at listening.
And I, these are my friends, and so, you know, it's not hate, and it's not, now don't buy their stuff or go to their, you know, whatever. It's not me trying to start a boycott, although I've been known to boycott a few things in my life. But if you feel like you have a platform, right, and you're good at something, you have a talent, right, where you can easily access, right, because privilege and oppression has to do with access. Sometimes we forget that part. It has to do with access to opportunity, access to economic resources, access, right? That's an important word. So if you have easier access, then the thing to do is, if we can't find, okay, so right now, in the art game, okay, there's not a lot of really, maybe, like, artists that are, you know, painting Mormon subject matter who are people of color, right? There's a few, right? But maybe there's not a whole lot. So we create opportunities, right? We go, we mentor, we try to do that. And in the meantime, because we can't wait forever and we have to keep doing our work and you have to live, right? In the meantime, understanding that you have, first of all, acknowledging that you have a bias. But what we know in the neuroscience research is that knowing that you have a bias is not enough. It doesn't mean that you do anything about it because you have it. So when you have a bias, you have to recognize it, right? And bias just means, like, it's I have this affinity toward this particular thing, this particular group of people, this particular idea, because that's the way that I've been socialized for generations, okay? So you recognize, okay, I have a bias. What you have to do then is actively fight against it, right? Okay, so next time you see someone you think it has a gun, right? This is a little tangent, but just because I'm trying not to get shot right now. But okay, so next time you think you see someone with a gun who's in a hoodie, who happens to be male and has dark skin and maybe looks like a demon, you need to say, oh, I have a bias that maybe I didn't know or realize. And so I have to actively fight against that. So instead of automatically, there's someone with a gun, he looks like a demon, calling the popo, right? What do? Is I actively do the opposite, which is I go and I gather more information, right? So I investigate the situation. Because if this person is going to shoot somebody up, yeah, we want to stop that. See something, say something, right? We want to stop that. But when we know that there's a bias, we have to actively act against it. Okay, so now I know, okay, there's a bias for me to just want to jump in and represent this art because I have this good intention. So I just want to make this thing, right? I have a bias. I want to make this thing, and it's going to be really good. Instead of that, jumping in and saying, I think I know how I should be representing Black Eve. Have you ever sat with a group of Black spiritual women? Have you been to Black church? Have you spent time with Black people, your subject matter? Have you immersed yourself in your subject matter? Do you think that a Michelin chef, five-star Michelin chef, or whatever Michelin chef, sits there and just starts making French food, has never been to France? No. You think they're going to win a Michelin star if they've never been to France making French food? No, they're not. Because Julia Child's book is not going to get you a Michelin star on its own. It's just not. Right? You have to immerse yourself in the culture before you make the French food. The same thing here. Before you write the book, right, not only do you need to spend time with the documents, spend time with the people. When you say, I want to write a book about this person, and if there's another person that has a similar story, maybe go spend some time with their family. See what you can do interviewing them. Spending time being uncomfortable, that is what's going to help you give more accurate depictions so that you know that, oh, when I see this Black Eve and, oh, that's beautiful, right? You know that Black women would say, that looks a lot like the auction block. I know that woman. Until you get there and say, I think this is what my Black friends, this is what my Latina, this is what my Pacifica friends would say about this, right? Don't do that work. And don't, but again, here's my boycott, don't buy that. Listen to, before you bring a piece of art into your home, before you buy a book, maybe just see what the reviews are. See what other people who look like the subject are saying about it. Other people who look like the subject, what are they saying about it? What are those critics saying? And I can tell you what. I said something because I'm still with y'all. I'm still with my progressive friends. And that's why I said something. I'm still on your team. My other Black friends were not going into progressive spaces saying this. They were just shaking their heads and saying, I'm not going to say a damn thing. Because I'm so done with these people. I'm so done with them. Always being perpetuating violence onto us. I'm so done. And because I'm not done, because I love you, I'm here and I'm saying the truth. And I love you. So we can do better. Let's do better together.
We have about 10 minutes. Would we like to open up to questions? No?
There's one quick thing I want to mention about, because you talked on the one hand about the long-standing existence of art made by people of color for communities of color. This is and then we also have this kind of Mormon art world, which is again predominantly white and no, but the audience that is the art is being produced for, okay, is mm-hmm. predominantly white. Mm-hmm. And as an example of this, there's a painting out in the exhibition area by Fidalis Bueller, who is a Pacifica artist. He's LDS. He teaches at BYU. And his work fits that description of people of color producing art for communities of color. And the painting out there in particular is quite a staggering piece, but it does not read Mormon at all.
Why not?
Because
I don't think you have to answer it. I'm just saying.
No, but I think that's exactly the question we need to ask: is why does art that looks like it's produced by people of color for people of color not read Mormon art?
If we have questions, can we ask them at the mic so that the recorder can pick them up?
I'm Terry Kramer, and full disclosure, I'm Brad's mom. I did want to say, boy, this has been very touching to me, and Misha, you've been paradigm shifting for me. I've always prided myself on being as unprejudiced as I possibly could be, and I've still got a long ways to go is what I'm realizing. And I'm one of those that when I walked into Brad's studio and saw that picture, I started to cry. And it wasn't just because it was different, it's because it felt like it was right. It was, I've seen pictures of Adam and Eve, you know, I've never seen one depicted like that. I've never had a visceral reaction to any picture I've ever seen, temple, anywhere, like I did to that picture. And I bought one, and my daughter bought one. My husband won't let it be hung in our house. And I think it's more, I mean, I honestly don't know that it has anything to do with it being Black Eve. I think it probably has to do more with, he says it's pornography. and we've got 10 little grandchildren, five of whom are Brad's. I can respect that if he's uncomfortable with it in his home, you know, that I'm not going to make him uncomfortable every time he walks in. But I want you to know my reaction wasn't because I hope it wasn't because I pride myself on being open-minded. It was because I feel like it looked like what I imagine Eve would look like. And it's just, I've only had a couple of reactions that have hit me that hard. And one time was, I remember exactly where I was and pulling over and crying when the blacks got the priesthood, because I thought Heavenly Father is up there and he's very grateful that we're finally getting it right. We've done it wrong for 100 plus years. And the other was when I saw that, and then also the same-sex marriage, when I was with my husband and just burst into tears, and he couldn't understand it, but I felt like it was God saying, okay, my kids are getting some things right here. So I walked into my daughter's house where it was, I was there in San Francisco 2 weeks ago, and when I walked in and she had Eve hanging on the wall, I burst into tears again. So for some of us, it is a visceral reaction, and it makes me feel like we are finally seeing what our history really is. We're finally uncovering the truth, and that's how it felt to me. So,
well, and I know that certainly people will have reactions, right, based on our station in life, right, the intersections of our lives, right. So while the painting to you was this positive experience, it was very painful for me. And for other women of color, it was very painful. And I can tell you two things that could have probably changed completely, right? Had Eve's face been forward and her chest covered. Now, I think I made a comment and said it was pornography. Not because of sex, that doesn't bother me. Whatever. I'm fine with that. I'm fine
with the exploitation of the body.
It's right. The exploitation of it. That's pornographic to me. Not the sexual.
Not the nudity itself, yeah.
Right.
Per se.
Not the nudity. White nudity is something completely different than black nudity, because black nudity is always tied to violence, rape, murder, genocide, and enslavement. That's completely different than white nudity that's tied to its own history and other things, right? So, I don't know if any of you remember the Whitney Houston album from like the early 90s, where she is bald and like she looks like a goddess. Like, that's what I think of when I think of Eve. But the difference is that she's facing forward, her chest is covered. And that is the way that typically that black artists depict Eve. Now, sometimes there have been depictions of Black Eve from black women who will show her bare-chested, but her face is always forward, and there's a difference, again, right, when you're a black woman producing something than when a white man is producing something, right? It's filtered through a white male gaze as opposed to filtered through the experience of being that, in the embodiment of that person. So, so again, right, two things. And that would have made the difference of making it painful to joyful, and I don't know what that experience would have been like for you. I don't know if white women would have said, like, well, I don't really care, because it wasn't as striking. Oh my gosh, she's nude, right? How would it have felt if your body, if it would have been a white Eve and she would have been nude, right? I don't know, right? Again, we don't know. Those are still questions unanswered. But I think it's really important to understand where
who the artist is, where they're coming from, and those little things that seem little are really big and change our experiences.
I don't know if you have something else to say.
I just want to say that things, what we would call iconography in art history, positioning, and it signals so many things. It signals so many things. Not long after we had our podcast about the Eve painting, I saw in a and I teach in an art department, so you know my colleagues have their art and other people's art all over their walls. I saw a painting by a colleague of a black woman in the same position, and I saw it. You know, like, and it was not hard when it wasn't called Eve to realize that this was a highly sexualized, exoticized body. That when we kind of stripped it of a title, that it was a problem. And that's all I'm gonna.
And you know, as we consume various kinds of art, and you know, as we engage in kind of like this, you know, watching things and viewing things, generally we don't like to feel guilty. None of us like to feel like we are doing something wrong, ever, right? So we go through a series of mental gymnastics to convince ourselves that we are not complicit, right? But complicity is a thing, and I'm going to tell a very brief family story, and Misha actually knows the person I'm talking about. My grandfather, he was a police officer in the LAPD, and he was one of these people where he was quite open about his ethnic prejudices. And we all knew it. It was no secret to anybody. You know, he was the kind of person where if you said, Grandpa, if I were to marry an African-American woman with a temple recommend, right, fully active member of the church, how would you feel about that? And he would say, I don't really feel comfortable with that. All that said, though, towards the end of his life, one of his sons asked him, Dad, if your son, like, would you want your son or your grandson to inherit your views of black people? And he said, no. Complicity is something that even he, as hardened of a police officer as he was, he recognized that he had been complicit in an oppressive system, even though he was widely considered to be a good person, upstanding member of the community. And that has been an inspiration for me personally. As we engage in any number of things, I always ask myself, am I, in doing this act, complicit in a system of oppression? And that includes viewing artwork. So.
Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but we're out of time, and I have to end.
It feels like you're cutting me off.
I'm sorry. No, I can't imagine a better way to start this conference than with this discussion. This was amazing. I'd like to give our panel a hand, please.